Thank you, Bob. Mr. Chairman, President Corson, President Rawlings, and friends, I apologize for keeping you waiting for 5 minutes to show you just how easily I have reverted to a professorial style. I forgot my notes, having come about a third of the way from Snee Hall to Rockefeller, and so I doubled back, sending a message with Maui to Bob, but I do apologize. I shall have, I hope, an opportunity later on to pay tribute to Dale. But I'm going to talk this morning, I think, I don't remember the title, about universities at the millennium and the prospects before us. But I want simply to say now that what success the universities have had in the last 1,000 years is directly attributable to those who have loved learning, who have been its leaders, and have defended it well. And no one fits that description in all three categories better than does Dale Corson. It is a debt not only that Cornell owes to him for his love of learning, for its advancement and its defense, but also the whole Commonwealth of Learning. And it's appropriate that we should meet here in Rockefeller in the place that was the beginning of Dale's long service to Cornell. And so I salute him and thank him on behalf of all of us. It is fashionable at the close of the millennium to make lists of everything, the top 10 songs and the top 100 books and the top 50 inventions and the top 100 people. But if we made a list of the top 10 creations, inventions, if you like, of the millennium, I would argue that somewhere on that list of 10, and perhaps at the top, would be the university. The university is, after all, one of the few institutions that spans virtually the whole of the millennium. Bologna was founded in the 11th century. There's some debate as to precisely when in the 11th century. And that, to many, was the first true university. Salerno had a medical school before that, but Bologna combined canon law, civil law, and later philosophy under a system of governance and disputation and teaching that were to be the model for the medieval world. I grant you that other institutions have perhaps been more democratic than the university, representative government being one. The university is not a democratic institution. I grant you that other communities have been more inclusive than the university. A city, for example, includes all its citizens. I grant you that other societies and associations may have more direct impact on their members. One thinks of the Communist Party, for example. And I grant you that other inventions may have had more immediate benefit to the population at large. One thinks of antibiotics, or perhaps of information technology. And I grant you, too, that other corporations and perhaps other individuals are more wealthy than the universities. One thinks of Microsoft and Mr. Gates, amongst others. But few institutions are more durable, and few have had more continuing impact. In terms of durability, Clark Kerr reminds us that of those 80 or so institutions in the Western world that have existed in much their present form since 1520, of the 80 are included several Swiss cantons, the Catholic Church, the parliaments of Iceland, the Isle of Man, and Britain, and 70 universities, occupying in some cases the same premises, having the same faculty, teaching largely by the same methods, and governed essentially in the same style. I'm not suggesting that in a cyberzoic world we have paleozoic structures necessarily, but I am suggesting to you that an institution that has shown that remarkable degree of durability has to be a significant one in terms of the great creations of the millennium. Compare that, if you will, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which celebrated its centenary a year or so ago. Of the corporations that made up the original Dow Jones, only one is not just included in the average, but is in existence 100 years later, and that's General Electric. Other things have changed with startling rapidity. The university has been remarkably durable. It's also, unlike some other institutions that are the creations of this millennium, an institution of growing impact and growing significance. Throughout the world, universities, to an increasing degree, are agents of social mobility, with expanding patterns of admission, which give access to not only general education, but also professional training to groups who had long been denied it. They are places of growing contribution to knowledge. We're very conscious of that in our own country. It's equally true in most other countries, especially in the developed world. And they're places that continue to have a growing impact upon the societies in which they're embedded, not only in the general educational level that they provide, but also in terms of training future professionals and the technology transfer which is associated with them. These trends are true of most countries. But I want to suggest that the American research university, that sounds almost like an unnecessary qualification to talk about the American research university, but we all know that there are universities which are not research intensive. It sounds a little like talking about a musical pop group, but we know there are some pop groups that are not particularly musical, and there are also some universities that are not particularly research oriented. The research intensive university has had a history in the last century that distinguishes it from those in other countries. And I want for a moment, before we look forward, to look back and to ask, what is the recipe, in retrospect, for the extraordinary success of the American university in the last century? After all, if we'd been gathering in this room, which existed, and talking about the university at the turn of the last century, we had a participating population in terms of enrollment of about 4% of the college age population. Now that figure is 43%, and our forebears would have wondered at the tenfold increase that that represents and the positive impact that it's had upon our institution, and so in every other category. But what are the distinctive characteristics which have distinguished the American research-intensive university from others? After all, if you'd made a list of the top 10 universities, back to lists, if you made a list of the top 10 universities at the close of the last century, it might have gone something like this, had there been such things. Berlin, Cambridge, Cologne, L'École Polytechnique, Heidelberg, Göttingen, Oxford, perhaps others. If, on the other hand, you made that list today, it would, I think, be top heavy with universities in this country. In fact, the Asian Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago made such a list. And as I recall it, either 7 or 8 of the 10 were American universities. At 1900, we might have had 2 if we were lucky in the list. I won't name them, but they could well have been included. How do we account for that difference? I should say, I'm proud to say, that Cornell was included. This is just a footnote for those of you who are visitors, and you'll forgive our local pride, but Cornell was included in the Asian Wall Street Journal top 10. I think, first of all, one of the unplanned secrets of the success and the vitality and the vigor of the American university has been its remarkable institutional mix with a College of Arts and Sciences at the core of a research-intensive university, gathered around it a cluster of professional schools. This mixture of the humanities, of the social sciences, of the basic sciences, gathered within a cluster of professional schools, is one that has been remarkably successful, and one that one hopes will continue to add vigor to the character of the American university. I must confess, at the close of this century, perhaps none of the core departments of colleges of arts and sciences are as influential outside their own orbit as they were in 1900. But one hopes that that will change. The other distinguishing characteristic in terms of mission and mixture of the American university is its non-elitism. European universities, until the last 15 years or so, have remained remarkably elitist, with admission being highly selective, calibrated with the most mathematical kind of tests of scholastic aptitude. That has not been true of the American research university, and the mission and mixture have had a leavening effect upon the institution. In retrospect, I don't believe any of these things were consciously planned, but in retrospect, they've been remarkably invigorating. Second, and this was planned, American universities have enjoyed no single sponsorship. Unlike the rest of Europe, for example, where universities are state institutions, the American university has been feistily independent, including the public universities, which is a cause for celebration. Not independent enough, perhaps, as we all know, but independent nonetheless, where faculty members think otherwise, and long may it continue, in contrast to being civil servants in other countries, where the Ministry of Education, in a central government office, does not plan the expenditures not only of institutions as such, but of individual departments, and tell them what variety of computers they're allowed to purchase. The independence, the entrepreneurial, cussedly independent American university, governed by no one except its own board of trustees, answerable to no one at a national level except the general public it serves, has been one of the secrets of its success. And the paradox of Europe in comparison is that European universities were founded independently by religious denominations, by cities, by guilds and corporations, and they have been nationalized. The American research university was in part founded privately, and that's a cause for celebration, in part founded publicly with the great state institutions, the flagship institutions of each of the states. But in fact, they have been denationalized in a sense. And that lack of a national plan and the imposition of a national pattern has been a source of enormous strength to the American university. Third, I believe the governance has been distinctive. One has only to sit in the governing board of a university in Europe to compare it with the vitality of a governing board in this country. And part of the reason is not simply the constitutional authority, the difference between that and the two institutions. It's also that even in the public universities, the governing board has something of the responsibility to provide the funds, the wherewithal, the means of pursuing the mission of the university, unlike the dispensation of funds arriving from a central government source in other parts of the world. The governance, the independence of boards of trustees, the devotion of those boards, especially in the private universities, to the well-being and support and independence of the university have been factors of enormous significance. Third, the organization of an American university, a typical one, has been remarkably fortunate, and again in retrospect. In Europe, the department has been strong, and the college, the faculty, has been weak. In this country, on the whole, the department has been weak, and the college has been strong. And that, in retrospect, has been a remarkable success story. By the department being weak, I don't mean weak in terms of intellectual achievement. I mean weak in terms of governance, whereas in Europe, the department for years, literally until a decade ago, was the domain of one individual who ruled over it with a lifetime appointment, undisturbed by the wishes of the many, in most cases. In this country, though it has its weaknesses, an elected chair of the department, rotating all too frequently in some cases, has been a pattern that gave vigor and vitality unknown elsewhere. And the pattern of the professoriate, where a professorship could be the career goal of every individual, has been a source of enormous strength, as opposed to a traditional European department where only one person amongst perhaps 15 or 20 could aspire to that position. Clearly, the federal investment in science, medicine, and technology has made an enormous difference to the American university. This to the degree that we enjoy it is unknown in Europe. And grumble as we should that present funds are inadequate, the truth is that this has been perhaps the most distinctive single element in the success of the post-World War II American university. Funds dispensed by the central government, but awarded by peer review through the various mission agencies, has been a source of enormous strength. I think, in fact, size and scope, though we sometimes condemn them, have been important in retrospect in the success of the American university in the last century. In general, a department of 20 people will be better than a department of 5 people. That's not a universal law, but it tends to be the case. In general, a science department with 60 members will have a greater breadth of achievement and offerings than one with 10 or 20. And again, not universally true, but in general, there are certain things, especially in science, medicine, and technology, and to some extent now in the social sciences, perhaps less so in the humanities, that can be achieved only with massive investment of both people, equipment, and resources. And the size and scale of the American university have proved to be a blessing. And finally, I suggest that outreach and competition, unabashed competition, have served us well. Outreach because, unlike the studiously ivy-walled institutions of other parts of the world, the American university has been entrepreneurial in reaching out. A recent Bank Boston study of MIT pointed out that alumni and faculty of MIT had created between them more than 4,000 high-tech companies throughout the world, and those companies employed 1.1 million people with annual sales of $230 billion. One institution in one corner of Massachusetts with that kind of impact. If you scale that down and converted it to the equivalent of a national economy, it would rank 23rd in the world, that total, between South Africa and Thailand. The outreach, the entrepreneurism, the unashamed and unabashed competition between universities has served us well. Unplanned, opportunistic, feistily independent, well-governed, creatively led on the whole, as conservative in some respects as they are entrepreneurial in others, with a dedicated faculty, the American university is one of the great success stories of the 20th century. And so let the good times roll. Let's get on with the 21st and hope that all these things continue. I hope that's the case. But as we look at the context of the 21st century, we need to ask ourselves, just as those sitting in this room in 1899 might have asked themselves, have we got the right recipe as the world around us is changing? After all, knowledge now is the new economic capital of the world in which we live, and it's almost a cliche to say that, but we need to remind ourselves that we are in the knowledge business. Knowledge, unlike other forms of natural resource, is undepleted by its use. It is improved and refined, even it is challenged and tested. Other natural resources, things like oil and gas and minerals and raw materials, rivers and rainfall and soils and topography, all these things, to some extent, have a finite life. Not knowledge. It expands even as it is applied and given away. But knowledge is not a free good. It comes only to the prepared mind, and universities are the providers and extenders of knowledge. We live in a world where information technology, and I'm sure this was on yesterday's agenda, is more and more dominant, not just in e.com, but in everything that we do, except perhaps yet within the world of education. We live in a world where the context is one of relatively diminished public funding for higher education, not just in terms of state universities, but also in terms of the federal level of investment in competing with other social goods. We live in a world where access of underrepresented groups is now threatened by legislation and voter propositions in many parts of the world, where Florida, the state of Florida, has just proposed, in the face of the threat of a referendum on affirmative action in college admissions, a preemptive strike to offer admission to the top 20% of the high school graduating class. And the New York Times regards that as a great discovery and one that will solve the affirmative action dilemma. It solves almost nothing, in fact, and the whole concept of affirmative action is now under stress. Where accountability, especially in public universities, is not just a term of interest, but is a term of application, and where the most obscure and inappropriate measures of accountability are being applied in some states. And finally, where deregulation of higher education is now a reality, where the University of Phoenix, traded on the NASDAQ, has a price to earnings ratio of 50, and one looks at the enrollment and the extension of the University of Phoenix and wonders to what extent we're ready for that kind of competition. It has already 60,000 students, and as you may know, it's now setting up business in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh. This is the prospect that we face at the close of this millennium. And observers of higher education have two strikingly contrasting views as to what that means for our enterprise. On the one hand, Stanley Eikenberry, known to many of you as a good friend and great leader, the president of the American Council on Education, began a recent report of his, of the association, by saying, "American higher education is at the top of its game. By every measure, its vitality has never been better." That's the positive view. Let me give you the other view, which is shared by some internal observers. Eli Noam, a professor of communications at Columbia, wrote an article in Science a couple of years ago on the dim future of the research university. And he argued that information technology was going to do for the universities what the creation of printing had done for the great cathedrals of medieval Europe. It would deprive them of their monopoly as a dispenser of learning and information. The prospect is dim, according to Eli Noam. "Have we reached the end of a road," he asked, "that stretches back 2,500 years all the way to Nineveh?" And his general answer was yes. Or listen, if you will, to Peter Drucker, the management guru, who has on several occasions, most recently in an interview with Forbes magazine, expressed his dim view on the future of the university. "The research university I regard as a failure. Learning will take place outside the walls of the campus. Campus buildings, campus facilities are simply redundant," he commented recently. Or listen to Bill Reddings, the late professor of comparative literature at the University of Montreal, commenting recently in a book published by the Harvard University Press called "The University in Ruins," an understatement perhaps from one to give added emphasis. But he commented, "We must recognize that the university is a ruined institution while being willing to dwell within those ruins without nostalgia." I think Stanley Eikenberry is right, and that the rest of the critics are wrong. But I think Dr. Eikenberry will be proved to be right only if, in half a dozen or so ways, we face up to what seem to me to be a series of both short-term and long-term challenges. And the first is this, that I think all of us, collectively as institutions and individually as particular institutions, have to grapple with this extremely difficult question of mission and function and role. If you look at the explosion of institutions, we now have 3,600 institutions of higher education in this country. If you look at that explosion in the last century, it's been characterized by what I like to think of as the Harvardization of the campus. Every institution has sought to become like Harvard. The next century, I believe, will belong to those who are successful in de-Harvardizing their campuses, in creating their own models, which are strikingly different from the conventionally orthodox and accepted and respected ones. What that model is clearly going to depend on the particular institution, but equally clearly, that's a decision that needs to be made. We cannot pretend any longer that we can cover the whole academic waterfront with equal distinction and equal success. Second, I believe that we need to take seriously the whole question of what constitutes effective learning. And this, of course, is where information technology comes into the picture. This is linked very closely with two other factors. The first is cost. And the very fact that public funding of higher education is now declining relatively, not absolutely, as a portion of public spending, is an indication that the levels of cost we have enjoyed cannot continue indefinitely. And information technology represents one means, not only for reducing the cost of instruction, but also for improving the quality. And we have yet, apart from a few honorable but timid exceptions, to take that opportunity into our hands and to use it creatively. If we apply to information technology in education the same creativity that we apply to our research, great things will follow, and I hope that we're ready for the challenge. It seems to me the most vulnerable institutions in this pressure on costs and this debate about to begin, I believe, on effective learning are the residential campuses. We have what the economists would call, I think, a very high fixed cost base. Buildings like this, libraries with 6 or 7 million volumes, a huge investment in a static structure, whereas information technology is not only any person, any study, it's any place, any time, not at the convenience of the faculty, not in rigidly sequential form, not leading up to a degree, not on a take it or leave it basis, but in fact at any place and at any time. This is going to be a wrenching experience for the average campus. And it's also, I think, in both subtle and unsubtle ways, going to change the nature of the teaching profession. There are those, such as James Duderstadt, former president of the University of Michigan, who sees the teaching profession within the next 10 years, let's say, divided up into different categories. There will be TV producers who will have tenure, because they produce great web pages and great courses on the web. There will be great actors, the Steve Goulds and the Carl Sagans of the new generation, who will have tenure as great performers. There will be the researchers, and there will be the coaches and mentors. Not great lecturers in front of the room, but people there as facilitators of learning, mapping out the landscape of the curriculum for individual students. That is no doubt an exaggeration, but in fact, it is up to us, I think, to take into our hands the planning of the future of the academic profession if others are not to do it. The other issues that I think confront us are issues of partnership and the extent to which we're willing to form alliances with groups who have traditionally not been part of the academic enterprise. I mean by for-profit companies, with public municipalities, with governments of nation states, with scientific foundations and museums and others, with foundations. This is a big question, and it's clearly one that could occupy a great deal of our discussion time. But the fact is, if costs are now not to be borne by the public sector, and if there is a reasonable limit to the price that the public will pay for tuition at the independent institutions, and if private entrepreneurs for knowledge companies are making a profit from the very students that we once taught, then in fact we have to think of creative financial alliances and other kinds of alliances with hospitals, with schools, with other institutions that can serve our general mission without corrupting our general values. And that will be a challenging undertaking. Let me say a word about organization and management, because the remarkable thing, by any standards, is that the American university is an organizational enigma. If one looks at it, it's just about the worst way, in the corporate world's eyes, that anyone would plan a $1 billion-plus institution, as most research universities are. Yet the remarkable thing is that it works. And it works because of that magical phrase, freedom and responsibility. But responsibility is an essential part of freedom. And one of the challenges of the years ahead, as we defend our autonomy, is to match it with the level of responsibility that it's going to require. Governance, leadership, management of time, organization of the institution, all these are going to affect the future. But all of these are essentially institutional issues. And it seems to me in the middle of these institutional issues, there are bedrock values that go back to the founding of the universities, which we must restate and re-embrace if we're to succeed in the years ahead. That teaching is a moral vocation, that scholarship is a public trust, that service is a societal obligation, and that the independent, open community that the university represents is the essential means of pursuing knowledge. I believe Cornell exemplifies those in the fullest measure, that every day on this and campuses like it, those values are embodied. And yet, as we think about the new corporate university, with its external alliances and with its streamlined efficiency and with its information technology, those values will be threatened as perhaps never before. We shall see the specter of depersonalized knowledge, of self-referential scholarship, of self-motivated service, of tolerance only for current orthodoxy and present political fashion. And examples of that already exist in some places. The only antidote to that, it seems to me, is to embrace the paradox which has characterized the university since the time of its founding, that we are a community which insists on the values of community, but is conscious also that community depends on the individual. John Henry Newman, a century and a half ago, said a university is not a foundry or a mint or a treadmill, but an alma mater, knowing her children one by one. There are some universities in this world that are foundries and mints and treadmills. Not this one. An alma mater, knowing her children one by one. One by one, person by person, student by student. That is not only the recipe, the best we know, for educational success, it is also the basis for a free society and is the secret of a great and enduring university. Thank you.